Good morning.
Good morning.
He's gating in this morning, huh? You know, I would like to look at a program because then I can read the quote for this morning. Okay? Thank you. The quote for this morning. Song. Those who do not live in the single way fail in both activity and in passivity, assertions and denial. To deny the reality of things is to miss their reality. To assert the emptiness of things is to miss their reality. The more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. To return to the root is to find the meaning, but to pursue appearances is to miss the source. At the moment of inner enlightenment, there is a going beyond appearance and emptiness. The changes that appear to occur in the empty world we call real only because of our ignorance. So, Song San, like so many Zen teachers, is kind of repetitive. So, living in the single way, he tells us, rooted in a deep stillness, there's an inner enlightenment in which we're all connected. And that's what he's saying. And in Buddhist teaching, that's considered correct understanding. The first step in the Eightfold Path, but also the last step of the Eightfold Path, right understanding, correct understanding. And the way that's talked about in here, as I said before, is translated Tao. So living in this, it's translated way. Living in the single Tao, living in the single way, in order to do that, in order to not only understand it but live that way, we follow the whole path. We follow the Eightfold Path. So, as many of you know, we start with our understanding. It's a little bit superficial, maybe, but we have it. We can be rooted in this deep stillness. We have that understanding. And then the second step is our intention. Second step in the path. And that actually is, I think actually by far the most important step in the path, intention. Because intention is what keeps us coming back, keeps us working. The path is broken into generally, historically, into the two components, the behavioral component, maybe the left leg or maybe the right leg, and the meditative component. So the two legs that support manifestation of our intention, which is to have the understanding not just be something that we think about, but something that we actually manifest. So he says in these stanzas, that to deny the reality of things is to miss their reality. We need to appreciate the reality of things. We need to appreciate each other as separate people, and the world just as it is. And to deny that, to say, oh, it's all empty or it's all whatever, is missing something. And at the same time, that's the behavioral component. The behavioral component is for me to respect you just as you are. Not to say, oh, it's all stillness, just do things my way and you'll discover it. It's to respect you just as you are. And I would hope the same of you. Reciprocity, the right understanding, right? Interdependence, right understanding, right? And setting this intention over and over and over again to do the behavior and to do the meditation, speech, action, and livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, the meditation, and the behavior, over and over and over again. Long-term or overarching dedication to this path, referred to by Jack Kornfield as setting the compass of your heart, setting the compass of your heart to manifesting that understanding. So it's not just something you read about. And all of the great Zen mamas and papas of old did that, we think. We did, a lot of them we don't know, but we knew. I knew Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, they really did that, both of them. They really set the compass of their hearts. And whenever the compass got off keel, it came back. And we can do that too. We can do that too. Well, I was hearing Leo play this morning, shakuhachi player Leo Hansen. I was reminded of the shakuhachi player Koga, who used to live in Minneapolis. Koga, Japanese man, older than me, but younger than Katagiri Roshi, that's all I know. He decided when he was very young that he wanted to dedicate himself to the shakuhachi, the Japanese or the Chinese before that, bamboo flute that we've been hearing every Sunday morning, thanks to the wonderful spirit and playing of Leo. And Koga decided that when he was young that he wanted to do that. And he didn't get much support in Japan. Very, very little support. Very, very little support. Japan was modernizing, westernizing. They were into Western music. They weren't playing the shakuhachi in the Zen monasteries anymore. But Koga really wanted to do it. He thought there was something there that was worth pursuing. He had an understanding about the peace that could come from playing that and from sharing that with others. So he kept, I think, setting the compass of his heart on that. Long term. This is long term. Our life is long term. It's really short term. But it takes a while for us to realize something that we really believe in, that we really want. So Koga did that. And then Koga came to the West Coast and kind of floundered around there. But the West Coast was better than Japan, because at least there were counterculture people who would listen to him. They didn't pay him anything, but that's okay. I mean, it's better than nothing. It wasn't really okay. In between, he went to law school. Everybody in Japan said, Koga, you're smart. Come on. Go to law school. Don't do this messing around back in the 13th century. So he did go to law school. But his heart was not full. His heart was not expressing the deep sense of kinship that he felt from listening to the shakuhachi masters, listening to his own father, who was a shakuhachi master. So after law school, he went back to the shakuhachi, came to California, and then he came here because he had met Katagiri Roshi before. And he felt Katagiri Roshi was a kindred spirit. But here he had only very few students, he couldn't make any money, but he still practiced for hours every day. Not to be someone, not to get something, but to express himself. Because he'd set the compass of his heart. Yeah.
When I met him, I asked him how much he practiced.
Yeah.
He had told me that when he started out, he practiced 10 to 12 hours every day.
Uh-huh.
And since then, when I ran into him, he had a family, three young daughters.
Uh-huh.
I can only practice for 3 hours a day now.
Oh, yeah.
So
Yeah. So, recently he got an award. So then he went back to California, because at least there was more interest in California. There was more chance to have students, to play in concerts. And so he went back there, geez, I don't know, 1980 maybe? Maybe you remember, Leo.
I don't remember. Yeah. I first ran into him in 1990.
Oh, yeah, well, he went back to California. So then, recently, he got an award from the California Arts Council. A big award. And here's what he said. There is a secret in playing, to excel in playing the shakuhachi. Blow not intensively, but from your heart. Although technique is secondary, it helps to express your true self. If we are natural, we make fine sound. A little bit of Japanese English in there. We make fine sound. If we have an open mind, our sound will be mellow. If we have right attitudes toward life, our music will be acceptable to everyone. Take care of your sound as you would take care for yourself. So, but when I tell this story, then people think, oh, shit, you know, I can't do that. I can never do that. And that's the way I used to feel about when I was with Suzuki and Katagiri. Oh, I can do this for maybe a half a sitting or a quarter of a sitting, but to just do it over and over again and to really do it, to really keep resetting the compass, which you have to do because your mind is always going off. You have to do that. But Thomas Merton has his recommendation about how to deal with this. I think he must have been reading Dogen when he gave this recommendation. But I don't really know if he read Dogen. He advised a young activist. Thomas Merton, you guys know, was also an activist. Do not depend on the hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no result at all. If not, perhaps results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. By aligning our dedication with our highest intention, we chart the course of our whole being. Then, no matter how hard the voyage and how big the setbacks, we know where we are headed. So intention, definitely the most important part of the path. Definitely. And when we're off in our behavior or our meditation, we need to come back and reset our compass. And if it's hard to reset our compass, we're still pissing and moaning, then what's the understanding? Come back to the understanding. What's the understanding that we really want to manifest? Is it an understanding of interdependence? Is it an understanding that there's a stillness that permeates everything when our mind is slowed down? So although intention probably is this most important one, at least for this morning, I'm making it the most important one. Somebody or other said, the road to whatever is paved with good intentions, right? Hell. So, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, a couple of examples. Well, sometimes we start off with a good intention, but then we still think we have the good intention, but we don't have it anymore. All kinds of examples. And, you know, for right now, I'm going to pick on Ronald Reagan. He did have some good intentions, you guys. One of his good intentions when he was governor of California was to release people from mental hospitals, from mental institutions in California. There were thousands and thousands of people in those days in mental institutions. If you guys are old like me, you will remember that. Thousands and thousands. Well, he shut them all down. And his good intention was to, these people shouldn't be locked up. And of course, he had another intention to save money, right? But he did say at the time that the money could be put into supporting people in the community. Within 5 years in California, a part of San Jose I used to live in was a ghetto full of people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, anxiety disorder, and serious and persistent depression. and they were living on the edge. They were living on the streets. They were living in cardboard box houses, really cardboard houses, just like I used to see in Mexico when I was a kid. So here's an intention that kind of went awry, right? Went awry. It started off good. Lots of times they start off good, and then we get involved in other things. And it went awry for the whole country because Minnesota then followed what California had done. And still going awry. Still going awry in that way. Because if you go to any of the shelters, and I don't, you guys probably don't hang out in the shelters, you'll see they're full of people with mental illness. Full of people with mental illness. Mostly. Mostly. Another example of intention, good intention gone awry, maybe communism, right? Communism. I remember when I was young and I was studying Zen and I was reading about communism, not too much, but I was thinking, boy, that's like Buddhism, kind of. You know, we share. Nobody's better than anybody else. We don't compete. But what happened? Can we think of one communist experiment that worked at all? Well, but look at the basic understanding. The basic understanding is not that we're all in this together, that we're all interdependent. It's that there is an oppressor class and a class who are oppressed. And the oppressed have to rise up and do what they can to get their way with the oppressor. Well, that kind of duality is always going to cause big problems in the long run. I mean, how can it not? How can it not? And that's not, yeah, how can it not? And then there's also the problem in intention of separating the means from the ends. If we separate the means from the end, we're going down the road to hell, obviously. And that's one thing that Dogen talks about time and time again. And we know. Because the end really never justifies the means. So we have the long-term intention, and then moment to moment, we have to reset our short-term intention. Correct our behavior. Not bad, but just align our behavior with the teaching of living in the single way, the teaching of rooted in a deep stillness, teaching of inner enlightenment. So 20 years ago, one of the things I was working on interpersonally was apologizing. I can remember this. I was working on apologizing because 20 years ago, I don't know if it was 20 years ago or 15 years ago or 25 years ago, but you know, around then, it's not that I didn't apologize, it's that I had to figure out whether I had really hurt the person before I would apologize. You know, being a high, I'm a high T on the Myers-Briggs, so figure out, high thinker, right? Figure out, oh, did I really hurt the person or is it just their thing, you know? But I spent so much of my time trying to figure it out that I did not do much to build relationship. I did not do much to build respect, to build empathy. So I really worked on that a lot, for a long time. I kind of got apology down, not as a technique, but as a way of being in the world, a way of having a relationship with someone, or deepening a relationship, making it more full, more real, more authentic. Well, in the last few years, I've been working on a different aspect of apology. Because my thing now is that my thing the last few years is, most of my sins, to use my grandmother's term, Catholic grandmother, right? Most of my sins are sins of omission, not commission. And so I want to explain to the person, I had good intention. Look, I did this, I did that, I did the other. Well, I forgot, but I was da-da-da, I just put da-da-da. But what does the other person feel? They feel like I'm trying to justify myself, right? And I am. I am. I want them to see that I'm trying to be a good boy. They could give a shit about that. I've hurt them. The fact that I want to be a good boy does not help the relationship. So the last few years, that's what I've been working on that part. So now I'm pretty good, 82%. I just apologize. And then maybe later, if things are calmed down and cool, and you know, the relationship with my friend or my employee or my board member or my wife is just really cool again, then maybe I can say, well, you know, I really did try to do A, B, C. And then they'll hear it. But to always insert it, to protect ourselves, protect our small, fearful selves, is not what Sungsan's talking about. So we have to practice. This is the leg of behavior, the behavioral practice. Speech, action, livelihood. Speech, action, livelihood. And each of us has our own things. So the practice you need to do is not the practice I need to do. Maybe you're fine at apologizing. That's all you do. Well, okay, you got to work big time. You got a whole different type of work to do than me. And the other leg. Meditation. But before meditation, behavior also. It doesn't hurt to pause before reacting, does it? I mean, you're meditators, aren't you? Isn't that what we're practicing? Meditating? Well, can't we have a meditative breath before we react? Before we respond? If you feel like your buttons are pushed a little bit, can't you just take a meditative breath? I mean, you can sit 40 minutes facing a wall. You should be able to take a meditative breath when your buttons be a little pushed, don't you? So that. Build that into your life. Build that into your behavior. Pausing before responding. Breaking the spell of the past. We live in that spell. That spell, that delusional spell of the past. Don't we? But a pause, a meditative pause, it's possible to break it. Just for a moment, just break it. So the habitual response doesn't have to just pour out. You can see it trying to pour out and you can watch it, but you're quiet. You're just watching. Zen practice is just as much that as it is sitting facing a wall, isn't it? I would hope so. And if we pause, we can check out, well, what's my intention here in this situation? To get even with Ben for what he just did to me? To win? To show him that I know more terms than he does? To justify myself? Or is it to build a bridge? To build a bridge based on the first teaching, based on the understanding that we're always in reciprocity. We're always in reciprocity. Even if we totally think we're not. Everything is. Everything is. And in our meditation, our moment-to-moment focusing, we're bringing ourselves back. But moment to moment, we have to do that, and we get thrown off all the time by internal stuff and by external stuff. This morning, the door is supposed to be closed halfway, but through, so people won't be bothered. But nobody closed it this morning, and nobody came in either, so it didn't matter. But, you know, the door has not been closed. A lot of people have been coming through to go upstairs to the intro. And so, some people have been getting annoyed. Well, that's all, that's interesting, getting annoyed. That's interesting. So from now on, we are closing the door. But it is also good to watch yourself getting annoyed, isn't it? Isn't it good to watch yourself doing that? You have this little concentration, this little precious concentration. You finally got a little bit going on, and then someone opens a door and yammers. Ooh, that pisses you off, doesn't it? Ooh. Right? Right? But that precious concentration is a little bit too precious, really. It's really not what Song San was talking about when he says live in the single way. When he says rooted in a deep stillness. So when that happens, then is it time for us to pay attention to our physiological response, to our mental response, to our groaning and our going on and on about it. And just come back. Just come back. So that we can, as I've said in talks I've given in the past, so we can really soak ourselves in the Buddha nature sea. This is what this zazen is about, this meditation is about. Soaking ourselves in the Buddha nature sea. Getting out of the boat. Even taking off the wetsuit. In the boat, you ain't soaking yourself in the Buddha nature sea. With your wetsuit, you ain't soaking yourself. Your boat is the boat of all of your worries and fears and anticipations and comparisons. That's the boat. You think you're doing zazen, but you're not doing zazen until you get into the water. You sit and you look perfect facing the wall. It's not doing zazen unless you focus, try to focus. It doesn't matter if your mind wanders off 1,000 times. You just have to have enough patience to come back and come back and come back. Because that itself is the act of soaking. And that's why there are many different practices. That's why focusing practice is so important in Zen. Because we need to focus enough so that we can let go of enough of this crud inside so that we can just practice being here. If there's so much going on inside that we don't even get off the boat, the whole 40 minutes is up. And you think, oh, geez, that was easy. Yeah, it was easy because you planned your next week. Sure, you can plan your next year. Plan your whole life. But that ain't meditation, you guys. So that's why we try. And that's why I think you should do any technique, all the techniques. Don't try to do some Zen technique. Oh, do some Zen technique. That's cool. But any technique. Buddhism is full of techniques to bring yourself back. To bring your stuff back. Bodily techniques in which you focus on your breathing. You focus on your hara, your deep breathing. You don't try to breathe too deeply, but you let it come down. You focus on putting your mind in its mudra here. And you feel touching between the two thumbs. I've done that a lot. You just feel the touching, not too hard or not too soft, and you bring yourself back to that. Many, many different ways in which you can use your body, and then you can use your mind in many different ways too. You can repeat something to yourself with your breathing. You can do a loving kindness meditation for a while. You can do a Tonglen meditation. Many different things. Whole pantheon of things to use. It's good to be eclectic in this. But or you'll just stay in the boat all the time. Everybody will say, oh, he's doing perfect Shikantaza. But you're just faking it. Just faking it. Do you know what I mean? I think you do. Nobody's agreeing with me. At some point, we become penetrated by salt. At some point, we become salty. We just become salty. Especially if we're not looking to become salty. We're just doing it. We become salty. And then we're living in the single way. We're living in it. So, this intention, this resetting the compass, and it resetting our intention in this practice based on the attention, using our two good legs. This practice needs support, right? We need support. I talk about this a lot, but it's so important. Koga had no one except he had his dad. That's the only person he had. No one in Japan. But his dad had been a Koga, had been a Shakuhachi player, and probably, I don't know when he died, but he had, I remember Koga used to talk about him, and he'd been very encouraging to him. And so he had that support. He had that support. We all need support in doing this. We all need support and feedback from our peers, from teachers, about how we can exercise these two legs better so we don't fall over just using one leg, with both legs. We develop the muscular balance to use both of them. So we just finished practice period. We had 24 people signed up for practice period, which is about the number of people who are here in the room this morning, because nobody else wants to skate except you guys. 24 people. I just read all the evaluations. At the end of practice period, they all evaluate. Well, what are people like best by far? Having a buddy. Having a buddy. It was universal. All the classes were okay. What Tim had to say was okay. The book, well, it was all right. Having a buddy. 75% that I got back. They said that was the most important thing. We need support in this path. We need support. And we get to choose our own support, too. We don't have to use some person we don't like. Choose your own support. Choose your own friend. Choose your own little sangha. Create your own sangha. And luckily for me, I have done that for most of my life. Especially when I was a student, I always did that. Except for 1 year. For 1 year, when I moved to northern Minnesota from California, I didn't have anybody to sit with. It was a really rough year for me. In terms of my practice. My practice was just all over the place. My sitting was messed up, and I got discouraged. Then I found a friend up in Virginia, Minnesota, to sit with. He was not Zen, he was Yogananda. But it didn't matter. Who cares, Yogananda Zen? Who cares? He did Yogananda, I did Zen, we sat together. Then we both quit our jobs later, and then really sat together. We lived communally. Sat together for 2 hours a day for 3 years. He go at his read his Yogananda book. And I read my Zen books. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Don't you think? Why do we have to make this little Zen thing? I don't see Sung-san saying anything about that. Do you? So a few months ago, I went out to eat with another Zen teacher that I'd only meet with. Geez, I don't see this person. I'm going to call it a her, but it could be a he, you guys. I only meet with her maybe once a year or something. And she was saying, well, she was talking about, she was asking me about my support system. For being a Zen teacher. And I said, well, you know, I really don't hang out with my peers very much. And my wife's not very interested in Zen. In fact, she has zero interest in Zen. I said, but you know, I feel like I have support. She said, you have support? I said, yes. I feel like my first teacher is always in me. And I said, I know that's weird, but I feel that way, that he's always in me. And she said, oh, I don't think that's weird. She said, that's the transmission. And I thought, oh, is that the transmission? Really, really, that's exactly true. It's exactly true. It's all this talk about the transmission, I just gave transmission. Maybe so. Then I came across something by Ramakrishna, who is one of my favorite Indian teachers. When I used to spend time at the Vedanta temple, I spent a lot of time there. When I was a Zen student in San Francisco, every day I went, did Zazen at Sokoji, and every Sunday I went to the Vedanta temple. Every Sunday? Maybe every Saturday. I can't remember. Ramakrishna died. Just before his death, when the doctor said, now he cannot survive, Ramakrishna's wife, Sharda, started crying. And these are Ramakrishna's last words. He said, don't cry, because I'm not going to die. What the doctors are saying applies only to the clothes. He died of cancer. And Ramakrishna said, as far as I know, there is no cancer in me. The cancer applies only to the clothes. So remember, when doctors say that I am dead, don't believe them. Believe me, I will live. And Sharda, he had married at a young age, if you know about Ramakrishna. She was much younger than him, and she actually became his student. So she became his student not too long after they got married. And Sharda was the only widow in India, in the whole history of India, who never became widowed. Because Indian widows, when their husbands are dead, have to change their way of life, their very style. They cannot use colored clothes, because color has gone from their life. They cannot use ornaments, because for whom? But Sharda continued the same as she was when Ramakrishna was alive. And people thought she had gone crazy, and they would come and say, now throw your ornaments, particularly the bangles. Break them. You are a widow. And she would laugh and say, should I believe you or Ramakrishna? Because he said only clothes are going to die. Not I. And I was married to him, not to his clothes. So should I listen to you, or should I listen to Ramakrishna? She listened to Ramakrishna, and she remained married to the very last. And she lived in such ecstasy because this listening transformed her. She became aware of a fact that the body is not the real. She continued her old way of life. It will look crazy because in this world of mad people where clothes are thought to be real, where boats are thought to be real, where wetsuits are thought to be real, somebody behaving in such a contradictory way is bound to look crazy. She must have known something. And this was not for one day, but for many years. Just this simple message from Ramakrishna, only clothes are going to die, not I, transformed her into a holy woman. She became, in her own right, an enlightened person. So Song San says, the last stanza that I read, the changes that appear to occur in the empty world we call real only because of our ignorance. So, the central tenet, right? Everything is changing in Buddhism. What's Song San say? The changes that appear to occur in the empty world we call real only because of our ignorance. Oh. There's the outer world. Everything is changing. There's something in here that doesn't change. It's not a thing. It's not a thing. It never changes. So, Bodhidharma says a special teaching outside the scriptures. A special transmission outside the scriptures. Excuse me. A special transmission outside the scriptures. No dependence on words and letters. Direct pointing to the heart mind. Attaining enlightenment and becoming a Buddha. But is the transmission that special? Is it really that special? Or is it something that maybe is going on? Always going on. So I'm going to finish with a Sufi story. For many years, Mullah Nasruddin used to cross the border frequently from Turkey to Hungary with only a donkey and a backpack on its back filled with hay. The border guards were sure he was smuggling something, but they did not know what. Each time they would search more and more thoroughly. They would go through all that day, even look in the donkey's mouth, but they never found anything. One day, one of the old border guards, who had by now retired, walked into a bar, and there was Mullah drinking and having a good time. So he decided to find out the answer to the mystery. He went up to Nasruddin and said, "For 15 years you've had us bewildered. We know you have been smuggling. Now listen, I am no longer on the border patrol. I give you my word of honor that I will not turn you in. But for my peace of mind, you must tell me, what in the world were you smuggling?" "Donkeys," Nasruddin replied. So that we need to counterpoint that to this special transmission stuff. Donkeys. Donkeys, right? Always here. Always here. Always riding on the truth. Always riding on stillness. Even if the donkey seems wobbly, going the wrong way. It's not going the wrong way. How can it be going the wrong way? So, exercising our legs so that we can manifest this wondrous being that's always available, this wondrous energy of the life force, the death force, the no force that's always available. Questions? Comments? Questions or comments?
This transmission that you refer to, is it an identity?
Or no. Oh, no. What? Is it an identity?
Smuggler.
Yeah.
Could you create a metaphor that would suggest that perhaps it were the donkeys?
Sure.
That we're being smuggled into this by someone.
We're the donkeys. Let's see. We are the donkeys. Well, of course. Why aren't we the? Of course, we're the donkeys. Well, but what's your point? What's your point?
I mean, could a rivalry or a jealousy or envy exist with, you know, the individual that introduced you to this? Could there be a schism or?
Well, there are always schisms. There are often schisms. We often schisms because we often fall back on our fear body and the needs of our fear body. But I'm not dealing with your question well.
Well, how do you overcome that?
By soaking yourself in the Buddha nature sea till you become salty. Getting out of your boat. Taking off your wetsuit. Forget the temperature of the sea. If you go into it, you'll experience something. And then what you experience is you want to get right back out. Well, that's okay. And next time you go in, you'll stay a little longer. You won't be freaked out by the so much extra seaweed. And just be able to be there with people. Over and over again. Till you discover that these legs you have are all you need. And you don't even need them. But you have to exercise these legs. Both of them. And if you fall into just stressing more the meditation and not the behavior in daily life, that's not cool. And you have to, or if you focus more on the ethical behavior and don't forget the meditation, then the ethical behavior is going to come very dry and tight and preachy. Ah, that's not cool. Come back. Come back. And you get support from others. You find someone to support you. One or two people or 30 people to support you. The secret of 12-step programs. Without the sponsor, what would 12-step programs be? Will 12-step programs have evolved into anything without the sponsor? But you have to find a sponsor that you can really bond with, that you can really work with. Maybe that sponsor worked for a while and then you don't need them anymore. Maybe you'll need someone else. We're all in this together. Yeah.
When you were telling that story about the man who died and
that
reminded me of, I was listening to a talk by Kenna Children doing it in Colorado. And you know, she's quite old and getting sick and whatnot. And, she said something like, it seems to me a lot of people, especially in Colorado, are really into worshiping their body. And they're working out all the time, and they're tanning it, and they're coloring it, and they're painting it. And she's like, you know, that's great, but you have to think about the impermanence of your body, such as, it's like a hotel room. You don't rent a hotel room and then redecorate it.
That's pretty good. I like that. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Cool. Yeah.
So then she went on to say, you know, it's okay to take care of yourself for the purpose of helping others. Live longer to help others. But it's not really okay to take care of yourself because you don't worship me.
Yes. Yes. We start making our body too precious, then we overlook the preciousness of this wonderful interdependent being that's always here. Good. Yeah. Pamela. About 5 years. And I haven't about 5 years, and he died in 1972. And what I also said to my friend, and I just almost gave this person's name. I'm not supposed to do that. What I also said to my friend was, you know, I don't think about him. I don't think about him. I don't have images of him. I don't read his books. That's not it. That's all clothing. This isn't about clothing. It's about the true, something true.
You talked about transmission happening all the time.
Well, I formally got transmission from Karen Suna, who got transition from Katagiri Roshi. Feel any different? I don't know. I've just been soaking myself in this Buddha nature sea for years and years and years. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. And I don't even like to talk about transmission. Because then we want something and we're trying to get something. I don't know what it is. It was her idea that it was transmission, not mine. She said it. And I thought, oh, that sounds cool. And of course, I gave transmission to Lee, but I have no idea what I did or he did or what we'll do next. And here I see shrugging his shoulders. So, but there's something going on. There's some wonderful exchange always going on. Of an energy that we put labels on, and this exchange of energy is always going on. So the transmission is always going on, but nobody's transmitting something to someone else. On everybody's transmitting something to everyone else, right? I don't know. It's like this huge electrical network. What's being transmitted in this huge electrical network? Sometimes the lights are on and sometimes they're off. It's the same electricity pulsing through the body, pulsing through the being, pulsing through cancer, pulsing through back pain, pulsing through anxiety, pulsing through gray calmness. It's the same electricity. It's not electric. It just is. It's just donkeys.
Tim, when you were talking about transmission here, and when you were talking about stillness inside,
mm-hmm.
do I interpret you to mean that those are not different things, or are they distinct?
That stillness inside, and say that again.
You were talking about finding the stillness inside.
Yes.
You were talking about transmission.
Yes. Yes, actually, when the mind completely settles down, so it's not separate from anything, it really settles down. It's called no mind in Zen, but don't worry about that. It's just something you get confused about. It just completely settles down. Then, in that stillness, in that silence, we're filled up by everything. We're filled up by everything. So I might call it Suzuki Roshi, because maybe that's my memory trace. I feel that it's Suzuki Roshi, but that's just a label. That's just a label. We're always being filled up anyway, but we don't notice it because we want to categorize it. When we stop categorizing and just let ourselves fill up, that's really what you could call transmission, but that word is totally inadequate. Totally inadequate. But yet, it has some use. It has some use. I don't know if that deals with your question.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Anybody else? Well, this is kind of a woo-woo lecture for skating here on a Sunday morning, wasn't it? Oh, well. Thank you.